because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind basketballimmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. Excited today to have a basketball conversation with Mark Jablonski. Mark is a frequent guest of mine at Breakthrough Basketball Camps throughout the U.S., and we formed a wonderful friendship through the years and has been exposed to many of the concepts that I've been sharing and has challenged me in so many ways to be a better basketball coach with his questions and his insights into the game of basketball. And give you a brief background, Mark played Division I basketball under Hall of Fame coach Chuck Daly and former Houston Rockets GM Bob Weinhauer. He currently coaches at Avenues, the World School in New York City. He's also coached AU basketball, has his own private training practice, and is consistently ranked as one of the top 10 basketball trainers in New York City on coachup.com. And most importantly, just a wonderful human being that loves to share the game of basketball like me. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Coach. How are you?
Wonderful. Great to have you here. And I know when we have these conversations, and our plan is for you and I to have many conversations over the next little while with these podcasts, is that we both share some ideas and some of the things that we've been exposed to, but really we dig deeper into some of the topics that I share on basketball immersion. So I'll let you start.
Yeah, Coach, I think one of the things I get a lot of questions on is really how BDT is applicable to all the different levels of coaching. I think the easiest one I know for me is at high school level, because you can see the direct input. And quite frankly, at high school level, one of the things that I think is really amazing is the amount of time and the time efficiency of it that really helps is helpful to high school coaches.
I think what you're saying is that for players that don't have the base to which to evolve into BDT, and that's the question I get frequently as well. And the easiest thing to talk about in terms of basketball decision training is essentially a method of combining skills practice with decision practice in a non-competitive way. So there's no competitive. Really true decision-making, if we're talking about developing true decision-making, has to do with live offense versus defense. I mean, that's true decision-making. So what basketball decision training is it's a gap between on-air isolated training between that and actual live one-on-one. So when I originally created it, it basically helped me frame for my players the decisions that they would be making in live one-on-one advantage-disadvantage situations. So that was why I created this, is to be able to go quicker into the decision. Because I think constantly we talk about the fact that we spend so much time on building skill, and then we get into a game situation and we go, well, why can't they make a decision? Well, the decision actually happens before the skill in a game. So basketball decision training is a way to be able to frame that. At the same time, you're working on them understanding the decision. You're getting them to apply the skill. And for coaches, I think the challenge is that they worry about, and I'm guessing that's your question, that we're overloading the young learner, that this is too much to be able to handle. Is that what we're getting at?
Yeah, I think a little bit of that. And also for like particularly younger players, I think the question is, well, are we not teaching fundamentals or are we not teaching skills? And I know that you've addressed this a couple of times in our conversation. It is teaching fundamentals, just a different way of teaching them.
Right. It doesn't follow kind of that those historical and cultural norms in terms of how we build skill. It really just mixes things. And yeah, it's a little bit more challenging, but based on the evidence-based learning and based on my experience as a coach, is that it's going to look a little messier. It's going to look a little uglier. But in the long run, it simulates a game, so it transfers a little bit quicker to the game. So let's break it down. The first part is, like all coaches, footwork is king. So when I do basketball decision training stuff, it all starts from the feet. And it starts, we use the term fight for your feet. That's how we've coined it. But it's really a concept that focuses our players immediately, at whether it's at my level or a young learner, on the fact that they're focused on their ability to get their feet down to the ground and to be able to make a decision because their feet are on the ground.
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that we talked about too is the footwork is so important, but you also talk about that getting players in that sort of aggressive offensive mentality at a very young age and training them to look at the basket and be aggressive going to the basket.
Well, it all starts from the feet. And then once your feet are down, then it's into the decision process. And you've obviously made that decision perceptually before you've even got your feet to the ground. But the focus is on every player catching to be able to play offense. And we're going to circle back to this, but if I think about youth development, I think the number one thing in my youth development approach is to increase a player's enjoyment of playing the game. Like if they're enjoying playing the game, then they're going to obviously be retained within the sport, but then they're also going to work towards improving their game a lot more if they're actually enjoying the process. And I think getting them right away focused on what we call 0 seconds, which is the ability to be able to catch the ball, ready to shoot the ball, or in a young learner's progression, if we're not worried about shooting, catch the ball to drive the ball, that we're getting them focused right away on being skillful. And I think the problem with a lot of youth development, and we're talking about one of the reasons I love BDT, is that we're focusing them immediately on being an active participant in the offense. Because too often we see players catch the ball to pass the ball. And some of that is offensive philosophy, where a coach emphasizes we got to run this set or we got to make this number of passes. But a lot of that is just because a player is not skillful enough to be able to execute a shot or a drive situation. So BDT immediately focuses them on getting their feet to the ground. And then once they got their feet to the ground, are they shooting it? Are they driving it? Or are they passing it, with a big emphasis on catching it to shoot it? But again, prepubescence, the focus is more on catching it to drive it. Because I think we know if a young player can handle the ball and drive the ball, that they're going to have that a lot more aggression that goes with that mentality.
Right. And I think correspondingly, I think we've also all talked about at that level, a team that makes the most layups wins.
There's no question. I mean, the layup at the youth level is king. And being able to drive the ball and draw help or drive the ball to score, I mean, those are mentalities that we try and bring to BDT. So I get asked frequently, again, well, how do you use BDT with an 8-year-old? Well, we don't emphasize the shot. We emphasize the drive. And the solution is the drive. So we'll mix in, instead of shoot it, we'll mix in drive it or pass it and the counter off the dribble. And the counter off the dribble is, as you know, or anyone who's been exposed to some of my teachings in camp settings or whatnot, is to be able to counter while seeing the basket and basically limiting the spin dribble as a counter, because that becomes a default for youth players who can't handle the ball and can't change direction as they go to a spin dribble. And too often that becomes obviously a bad basketball decision, but you know, a lack of skill demonstrated as well.
Right. And I think the other point I always like to make here is that this isn't just kind of you and I saying, this goes to really the core of teaching basketball or teaching anything. And there's a lot of evidence-based learning research on this. It supports this kind of learning, the random practice and the decision training, hard first instruction. Yeah.
No, and absolutely. I mean, again, the whole development, I mean, you can certainly Google and get into basketball decision training and a little bit of how it developed. But, you know, it's based on research, and more so than based on research, it's based on trial and error and experimentation on my part. And I've been very fortunate. Obviously, I've had access to some pretty high level players, but I've also been able to, you know, have a lab, so to speak, in terms of traveling around and doing basketball camps throughout North America. So I have a lab where I can go into and I can try certain things and find out how young people relate. And so much of what I do with my university players and so much what I do with young players is the same thing. I had a workout last night with two players that just joined our program, and the focus was back to the beginning. And I'm not apologetic for that for some of the players, you know, that are within our program, because when I do it with BDT, my older players who have been exposed to a lot of these teachings, they still make mistakes. So I'm still challenging them. And that's the other part of BDT that I think it's, when in a youth basketball setting, we have variable levels of players in terms of their skill, in terms of their abilities, in terms of their focus, all those different things. And I think BDT can challenge both the new learner and the experienced learner at the same time, depending on how many cues and depending on how your partner obviously challenges you with the different cues. So that was great to see last night, because I did have concerns about some of my veteran players about how they would welcome me going backwards, so to speak, and focusing on the fight for your feet from a very basic level, progressing into ball pickup off the dribble, and then the stab dribble concept, which is just getting to the ball to the floor on first step. And it was great. I mean, it was something that was able to be sort of seamless in that sense, that the challenge was still there at the different levels.
Yeah, and that scalable thing, I think, is really important, because it allows everybody to stay challenged, right? Because, you know, we talk about always learning takes place at the edge of your capabilities. And if you're going too slow for the lower players, or the slower players, the less accomplished players, that means that your better players aren't getting any better.
And isn't that the challenge? I mean, I guess that's probably the second most frequent question I get from youth coaches, especially in a lot of the settings that I teach BDT. And that's, well, what about your 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 player on your team in terms of skill, if you're ranking your players? And I am a big believer in that we coach to the highest level. And I don't mean that in the sense that we lose the lowest level, but I just mean that I want to constantly make sure that I'm challenging the highest level to be able to improve. Challenging the highest level usually brings up middle level. And then hopefully from there, though at worst, you're giving the lower level a task representation of what they've got to work towards doing and work towards achieving. And I think that's really important. And that's another part of basketball decision training, the BDT concept, that mixing these skills together simulates the game. That you're not just going to go out in the game and you're going to shoot 10 shots from the same spot in a blocked method. You're going to play the game in a very random way, and you don't get to shoot every possession. At least I didn't as a player, and none of my players do. So you've got to mix in the ability to attack off the dribble, the ability to pass, and all those things are mixed together in basketball decision training.
Yeah, so that sort of covers the younger stuff. Let's talk a little bit now how we get the value of it as applied to like NBA and say the elite college level.
Well, it's so interesting, because in so many of our conversations, I think you were the one that brought this home to me, is the fact that, like, how much can you improve Steph Curry? Like, really, from a skill perspective, how much are you going to add to his toolkit that is going to make that big an improvement? Like, is he already a good enough shooter? Is he already good enough off the dribble? Well, certainly there's small percentages of things that we can add to someone like that's game. But the real thing is, how much can we improve his decisions? How much can we improve his application of the skills that he has? And you've heard that about a team like Golden State throughout a season, is that how careless they are with the ball. Well, I kind of actually would get worried about someone interpreting that the wrong way. Like, part of their carelessness is their willingness to be creative and be free. And how much of that do you eliminate and take away their ability to play the game the way they do? And all that comes back to decision-making. So a player at a really high level, I would say the most significant impact we can make as a coach is on improving their decision-making, and improving their decision-making within the context of not just the opponent, but within the philosophy of how you're playing the game and within your teammates' abilities as well. So I believe the basketball decision training concept brings that right to the forefront for a player. And we would add different things and load different things, and there's seven or eight different cues that we could give a player, and we would incorporate those. But within each day, you could emphasize different things as well. If we want a player to work on a step back, or we want them to work on some type of hesitation or whatever, then you can add those cues and emphasize those things every day. But we're just not going to do them in a blocked way where it's over and over again the same thing. We're going to mix them into other decisions and other skill applications so that they develop it in a very game-like specific way.
Right. And I think that's huge too, because even for you say a guy that's maybe sixth, seventh, eighth guy in the NBA, that move to this sort of positionless basketball that BDT really encourages too, is that you're not locked into a position. We're not going over your post moves, or we're not going over, we jab step and cross over and jab step and cross over. And I know, I think we've both seen NBA guys working out in the gym, and it's just so funny to see a guy at that level do a jab step and then cross over and drive to the rim 17 times from the right side, and then 17 times from the top of the key, and then 17 times from the left side, while his trainer's just sitting there watching him do that. It's hard to see how that really is getting anybody any better.
Yeah, and what are there? Maybe on each NBA team, there's one player that is truly an isolation player that would get isolated in that situation. The game would slow down, and they would jab step and attack, right? And every other player has to learn how to play as quickly as possible out of those situations. So I would agree. I mean, if we're spending, like, clearly James Harden is going to be isolated. So the players that play with James Harden, by and large, I mean, they're unique because obviously they have one other player that's isolated too. But the players that play off of James Harden, they don't need to work on that game slows down, jab, 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 and play. They need to work on being able to shoot it and drive it or move it for that extra pass, that good to great pass off of that situation. So BDT in those ways, I think, again, I mean, it prepares those players more directly for the impact that they're going to make on the game. And the other thing that I know we've both seen is how many players shoot just block shots over and over again. And I mean, this is whenever this podcast officially goes up, I mean, you can go back and YouTube draft workouts, but go watch some of these NBA pre-draft workouts and you see players from 7-footers to 6-footers and they're making 25 threes in a row from a spot. Does that surprise you, Mark, that those players can make 25 in a row from a spot?
No. And then we go to the 7th game of playoff and guys are shooting 3 for 44, 7 for 44, right?
Well, and that relates to that is, like, again, how much can I improve someone's shot? Well, I don't think it's about how much we improve the shot. I think it's the method of practice that I think we have to investigate a little bit as coaches. And it's been argued to me, and I 100% agree with this, is that if you go to a pregame and you see a Kyle Korver shooting mass number of reps from a block spot, so he's shooting over and over again, corner threes, and he shoots 10 in a row, and he makes 10 in a row. Well, yeah, that doesn't transfer to a game because that's not how he's going to shoot him in a game. But what it might do is it might build his confidence. And I want coaches to understand that that's really important, that I'm building a player's confidence. And I've always thought that maybe in one of those pregame settings that block practice might be important because ultimately we're trying to improve their mind for that game. But beyond that, I mean, I would think that every shot should be as much as possible simulating the game. And right. I'm sure you're going to ask this, so let's talk about it. What does that mean? What does simulating the game mean? Because I know we've seen it as, like, okay, coach at the top, player cutting off of the wing, there's a chair there, they cut off that chair and they shoot a curl, they shoot a flare shot. Okay, we're simulating the game. Well, are we simulating the game or are we just getting shots up in a game-like way, right? Like, is that a game-like way? Well, in the absence of a defender, the question is it game-like? And I would argue that in the absence of defender, it's not game-like. It's just, you're just shooting shots. You're simulating a little bit of shot you would shoot, but it's not adding any type of distracting information or, you know, perceptual stimuli to that catch and shoot situation or catch and drive situation. So, you know, what people call game-like, I would argue a lot of time is not game-like.
Well, yeah, and I mean, if the chair for a pick 15 times in a row from the same spot, it's just a different kind of block practice.
Totally, totally. And even if you mix it a little bit where they'd alternate between a curl and a flare, you know, and a reject, then yeah, you're making it a lot more random. But I would still argue it's not game-like because they're not actually reading any type of visual cue from a defender to make those decisions. And the hard part is I don't think it's a skill. Like, I don't think it's a skill of making the V cut. It's not the skill of making the backdoor cut. It's the skill of reading whether you should make a V cut or you should make a backdoor cut. And that's where we need the defense to be, you know, whether it's defense with guidance or it's defense in a live situation. We need the defense to be able to make those decisions because they're the ones that present the distracting information and visual cues that are present in a game.
Well, and you know, you mentioned Steph Curry. I saw an interesting article the other day too, where he's the only player in NBA history that has increased his accuracy in 3 straight seasons, his shooting accuracy, while taking at least 7 3-point shots a game. And I thought the interesting thing about that was the guy that he works with as a trainer said one of the reasons why you're seeing his shooting improve is because he's getting stronger, for one thing, but also his mechanics are getting better. And they talked about working on ball pickup and ball pickup from different angles and training off the move or training off the dribble and doing a lot of things that challenge his balance, and then contrasting that to what they do in a game. And they're saying that one of the things that like Steph really feels is that helps him feel really stable on the floor, even when he's moving at a shot for high speed and stuff like that. And if you can make him better and force defenses to react more to him or to react to him in a different situation, and he's just not a stand-up three shooter, which I think we've seen is now, you know, he's added the drive to his game. And
right,
I think he's making much better decisions and has a greater tool set than he had before. But, and I'm sure that BDT is part of that. It certainly sounds like from the trainer there.
Great information. And, you know, you look at a player like that and you go, well, how many times does he get a straight spot up shot? Like, never. So, you know, we talk about players at that level, like, yeah, it's almost like block practice would be a waste of time because they just don't get those shots. They're always moving. Even when they shoot without dribbling, they're always moving, or they're always at a kind of an awkward angle prior to the catch because of the pressure the defense puts on them. So, you know, a lot of their catch situations are not pure, just stand there, the ball gets kicked out, I'm wide open, I shoot. So I think that's even more important that, you know, someone like that would work on those skills of catching it at different angles, at catching it to get their feet placed, not necessarily square, but just in a situation where they get their balance to be able to shoot. And then, as we said, ball pickup. Ball pickup, so people know, is what we refer to as ability of a player to have a system of picking up the ball off the dribble, where they consistently pick it up exactly the same way from their right or their left hand. There's a difference in terms of how we frame it, but there's a system in place that's not random. They don't pick it up in the middle of their body or the side of the body or their ankle or their foot, that they consistently try and pick it up in the same location on either side of the body. So that's what we mean by that, but that's great.
And I think the other thing is, one of the things that I like too is that this is really an area where, as a coach, I feel like you can really make a huge impact in player development. During the game, right, you can make a couple of sideline out-of-bounds calls, maybe affect the game by 2 or 3 points. But over the course of the season, and if you can get all your players better and better quicker so that they're applying it to the game, which I think, again, is the end result of a lot of the BDT stuff that we do, is I think that's huge.
If you find a way to help them improve, then your roster's changing significantly, right? And that's what I think people, you know, who really value individual player development understand, is that whether it's through graduation and the next player's coming up from JV to varsity, or it's recruiting at the college level or the NBA free agency or draft or adding players, yes, that stuff can improve your team. But by and large, if the focus is on your roster without any changes, is if you can improve it, then your roster is changing because your players are getting better. And that's such a key part of all this, is that how much can you improve your players within the context of the game, like skills that actually apply. And, you know, the other part that I think we were circling back to a little bit is that concept of maximizing time on task. As a coach, you just have, I mean, especially if we're talking the youth level, you don't have that much time with your players. So if you spend 10 minutes on the three-man weave, and the three-man weave really doesn't have any transfer of anything, any skill or any decision to a game, then why are you spending 10 minutes on a drill that doesn't help your players in the game?
Yeah, I still haven't seen a three-man weave in any game that I've ever watched.
We'll make that a whole conversation, basketball conversation one day. But no, I mean, it just constantly comes back to that for me, is that what are we doing that is directly transferring something, whether it's a skill or a decision, to a player in a game? And that is the key for me. And any evaluation, like, I cannot evaluate a practice after a practice. Like, I have a feeling what the practice was like, but my evaluation for the week of practice happens after the next game. Because then I know if the stuff we were working on actually transferred to the game. And without that, I don't know how I could ever leave a practice. Like, what is it? Like, my players completed 20 straight passes in practice, and that was my evaluation of that practice. Well, in the game, we couldn't complete two, right? Like, it just, I've got to ultimately evaluate our development and our practices based on the next game. And competition is ultimately the thing that we're going to use to be able to assess our performance.
Well, I think it's interesting too there. Now, do you have certain metrics that you use for that? I mean, or is it a little bit of eye test? Is it shooting percentage? Is it player efficiency rating? Or,
well, I think we've got a little better
with that. I mean, my challenges, like many coaches' challenges, are just, you know, staffing and access to information. I mean, if we had Second Spectrum and some of these things that they have at the NBA level, you know, where it tracks different measures and different things, and I think we can get even a more realistic idea. For us, I mean, we've access to Synergy, so certainly we can look at certain performance measures within Synergy, whether it's a specific player, and we look at certain types of points per possession or different types of, as you said, analytics that help us evaluate a little bit better whether that player is getting better, then yes. But by and large, it's more of a, you know, as you go through the process, it's a feel. And then it's an evaluation, say, okay, it's even simpler. If we spent 10 minutes on zone offense in our practices and, you know, each day, and we played against no possessions of zone offense in the game, like, what was the value of me spending 10 minutes a day on zone offense? Well, I get the fact that we've got to be prepared, right? We've got to be prepared for everything. But, you know, the reality is what's going to directly impact our success in that game. And I would argue that the 30 minutes total we spent over 3 days of practice on zone offense took us away from the things that were actually going to impact our performance, which is kind of my point towards, okay, if I'm spending 10 minutes of individual player ball handling without a defender, and then we go into the next game and we play a team that presses us, well, I'm going to argue that, again, those 10 minutes that we spent on isolated ball handling, that didn't help us get ready for the game.
Right, and I think that goes to the retention factor, and from the teaching standpoint of, what was the John Wooden quote that I like, where he said the most crucial task of teaching is to distinguish I taught it from they learned it. And I just think that's a tremendous quote in the fact that players being able to retain the skills that they learn in practice to the point where they can apply them in the game. And I think, again, preaching to the choir here, obviously, but BDT, I think, is just a huge advantage to that as well.
It's a great quote for sure to remind everyone about, because, again, and I don't want people to think that we're like, if you're dribbling around cones, okay, that's fine. I mean, there is a value to that, but there's a limited value if you're doing that every day, because at some point you've got to add decision making. You've got to add this concept of, yeah, specificity relative to the game, but also the variability and the randomness of the game. And if you don't add that, then ultimately, again, we know based on the research, but also based on experience, that doesn't happen in a game. It doesn't. So you're not dribbling around cones in a game. So we've got to make it as game-like as possible. And like one-on-one off the dribble is more game-like, certainly, than dribbling around cones. So even if you get really good at dribbling around cones, that doesn't mean you're going to dribble well in a game. And that's where we want to make it as specific as possible in terms of the practice relative to a game.
Yeah, and Coach, I know that you've talked before, but in terms of like some of the key areas where players can make improvements, and I think you had them listed, I know at one point on the website, like ball skills and handling pressure, defensive habits, finishing moves, and then game understanding, which is really a lot of the decision training in BDT. I think those are interesting. Those for the team skills are very good. And there's things that you can do BDT with your team. How about in terms of a player individually, if they're working out individually, what would you suggest would be key areas where they can improve?
Well, and this, again, circles back to our comprehensive approach to player development. It's like, how do you improve a player's enjoyment of the game? How do you improve a player's confidence? You get them more skilled. That's it. I mean, you get them more skilled. They're going to enjoy the game more. They're going to be more confident the more skilled they are. Like, there's no magic to it. The most confident players on the floor are the most skilled players. Like, that's it. So if we're coming back, okay, we can't do BDT because we're all by ourselves. And a huge part of everything that we do at the camps that you've worked with me at is about getting players to understand how to work out by themselves. Because again, like I mean, it's honestly limited, like to a certain extent, the level that a trainer, a coach, a parent, a teammate can develop a player. Like it's limited. Those unseen hours all by yourself are the hours that are going to really separate you from other people. So learning how to work out on your own is paramount to success. So categories that you talked about, and I'll just summarize them for people a little bit, is, you know, the categories that I feel are most important are ball skills. That's dribbling and passing. You know, that's a player's ability to be comfortable with the ball. Are they comfortable with the ball? Because we know at the youth level, I mean, you're a better passer, you're a better shooter if you're comfortable with the ball. And that relates to a lot of dribbling and a lot of passing, whether that's individually being able to do something as simple as I dribble and I go crazy in random ways in a really small space, or I'm dribbling between my legs around my back and then I pass off the wall with one hand back to myself. You know, those are ways individually. I mean, there's tons. You can go on YouTube and search out all those things. And there's value to all those things because that's a player learning how to spend time with the ball and be comfortable with the ball. The second one is handling pressure. Like, I just think the separator at youth level is, can you handle defensive pressure? Like, if we're talking about offense, can you play when a defender's all over you? And because we know the secret. I mean, if you want to win at the youth level, other than playing zone, you're going to press. Because there's usually only one or two players on the floor that can handle pressure. So you're going to press. And if I know the other coach is going to do that, then to service my players' needs, I got to make sure that I'm developing them to be able to handle those situations. So we're going to work a ton against pressure. And some of that relates to the first point, which is ball skills. Can they dribble and pass? But a lot of that is that their basketball skills and mentalities. As much as possible, I'm going to put them in pressure situations where they got to play one-on-one in a small space and not turn over the ball. Or one-on-one, we call it line battle, get from one end to the other in terms of a small space or a large space with the ball, or it's some type of pivoting versus pressure that you can't lose the ball in 7 seconds of pivoting. Like there's all these things that help them develop that ability to be able to handle pressure individually. The next concept is defensive habits. Look, I don't think there's a lot of defense that we need to teach to the youth level, but I think we need to develop the habit of getting in a stance, putting your head below the player you're covering. The habit of putting effort in and then defining effort for players, right? What is effort, Mark? Like, what is effort? Like, we say this all the time, hey, work harder. But what does that mean? Do you define that for your players? Do you define effort for your players? For me, that's so important that I need to define effort. And, you know, we can talk about effort is, are you running your wing hard? Are you running your wing wide? Are you breaking the 3-point line to rebound on the defensive boards? Like, there's different things that you can hopefully quantify as we get more staff and different people to do it or access to stats. But qualitatively, can you point out things, whether it's through video or, you know, different things like that to be able to quantify that? But the concepts and competitive mindset of playing a ton of one-on-one as well, that forms a defensive habit. Getting a player to do like one-on-one zigzag drill in a stance, I don't think that builds a defensive mindset as much as playing one-on-one and getting stops. Like, can you play one-on-one and get stops? Like, will you fight to compete and keep someone there? Jump in whenever, Mark. But
I mean, make multiple efforts and stuff like that. Yeah. And I also like, again, from the teaching standpoint, specificity.
I think that's one of those words
that I struggle with too.
But right. So that when we're correcting, you know, we're correcting a specific action. We're not just saying, hey, like you said, you guys got to rebound better. Right. No, Bob, you got to box your guy out.
Oh, we've talked about this a lot.
Like general feedback is a big hindrance to learning, whether it's just saying good job or it's saying we need to do better, as you said. I mean, it's a huge hindrance to learning. Like if I'm not calling out Bob directly, and I don't mean that in a mean way, I don't mean yelling, I mean just, hey, Bob, we need to improve this because it helps us be this, right? You're pointing out not just the problem or what needs to be improved, but also the solution. That's so important because Bob needs to know that he's the one that needs to improve. And if I talk in general terms, I say, hey, listen, we all got to do better, then Mark doesn't think that I'm talking to him, right? Everyone thinks it's the other guy. So, I mean, that's really important, I think, in terms of specificity of feedback as well. And that word could be applied to so many things. So I think defensive habits is the third thing. And then fourth thing for me for youth development is finishing moves. Like I would spend zero time on shooting really from 15 feet and out at the youth level. Like, I think shooting is largely, yeah, we can get the initial concept, but it's prepubescent. It's mainly a strength barrier, unless we modify the hoops and modify the ball, which we know is not completely realistic. I mean, in an ideal world, sure, we do that. But we know that doesn't happen most places and doesn't happen because of the logistics of doing that more than maybe even the desire to do that. But so I would focus more a ton on finishing moves, scoring around the basket, different release points, like getting away from the stereotypical, I raise the ball above my head to release the shot, releasing it out to an angle, releasing it in front, releasing it behind, different spins, different types of releases from different angles, not doing stereotypical 45 to the rim layups as well, that you're working from different spots. And it could be one-on-one finishing moves, could be one-on-oh finishing moves, like just literally spending time scoring. Like, people talk about Kyrie Irving, and I know we've talked about this before, Mark, you and I, but like, nobody taught that guy how to finish at the rim. Like, there wasn't a coach standing there saying, hey, spin it this way, do it this way, do it that way. You know what he did? Man, he just went to a basket and he figured it out. Like, he experimented, you know? You know, that's what you'd hope to inspire in your players in terms of a lot of this stuff. And then the last piece is game understanding, which you mentioned already. And that's everything we've talked about already, which is decision making. Like, okay, fine, I developed ball skills. I developed a little bit more comfort in them handling pressure. I developed defensive habits. I developed finishing moves. But now, do they have an understanding of what to do with those skills? And that's where I think BDT comes back to, is that brings all those things back together in an easy to understand package with decision making and skills mixed together.
Right. And I think the other point of that too is that, as with the questioning and with the challenging and with, as you've said, making the players active participants in their own learning, that builds sort of the cognitive base so that when you go and you come up on a problem, hey, we've never practiced against a 1-3-1 zone, but players know the concept, hey, I want to be in a gap and I want to go to gaps. You can, right on the fly, make much more meaningful impact there in terms of coaching and having players really grasp it at that point.
It sounds crazy to coaches because
we're preparation freaks, right? Like, we want to be prepared for everything. We want our teams prepared for everything. But like, I'm a huge believer in not preparing your team for everything early in the season to do exactly what you're saying. Like, I try to not call timeouts. In the FIBA game, obviously, it's a little bit easier, but I want players, like, when they look at, I'm just, let's figure it out. Let's find a solution. Let's fight for our learning and find a way to solve this problem. That's a constant term that we'll throw out there in practice. But we also want that to happen in games. So look, we don't fully develop our press break concept early in the season. We really don't. Because I feel like if we practice against pressure, which we do a lot in practice in game situations, that we'll develop our understanding of the concept. Like, don't stand three in a row. That means don't stand directly in a line with the ball, a defender, and you move into a space. We talk about, obviously, advancing the ball as quickly as possible without dribbling. We talk about getting behind the ball if there's a trap. Like, we talk about these concepts, but we don't give them a system of organization for those concepts early, because I want them to be able to figure things out. And does that cost us a few possessions sometimes? Absolutely. But in the long run, that improves my players' ability to be able to figure things out, because, you know, we're not going to be prepared for everything and we got to figure it out. And there's never perfect spacing. There's never, you know, the perfect play, but there's plays that give our players structure to be able to figure things out. And, you know, it's those unstructured moments that I think ultimately decide games and who can play within those unstructured moments. So we try and create that situation. And I think, again, at the youth level, I mean, there's even more unstructured moments, right?
By definition, guys don't have any idea where they're going or anything.
Exactly. Exactly. So if you can give players a template for spacing and a template of understanding where to be in certain situations, then, you know, forget about whatever play you're going to run. I mean, that's the most important kind of system impact you can make on a player at the youth level. And then I think from there, you could run any play you want, because it's what happens after the initial play stop that's going to determine your success, because people are going to stop you. You know, that happens. They're going to take you out of something, and that's important.
Well, and I think that's, again, also at the, again, even more important as you go up to the professional level too, because you only have so many timeouts as a coach, and you know, you need to have, I think, be able to speak in principles rather than specifics, because you can't, hey, listen, if he does this, you got to jab and go right. If he does that, we want you to spin and reverse the ball. The player's got to figure that out on the fly. And I think it's so much more powerful to empower your players to make those decisions, and particularly at that high level where there's constantly adjustments going on, and where I think the basketball IQ is so much higher of the other players that you better be able to sort of go head-to-head with them on those decisions. Well, what am I going to do if this guy helps in from the corner? Or what am I going to do if I get double-teamed from...
Right. And I think there's a misconception by
coaches, or a belief that they do that, that they're doing that all the time. But the only way you're doing that is if they're in offense versus defense situations, whether it's 5-on-5 or small-sided games, and the players have some freedom. And I'm not saying complete freedom to do whatever they want. Like, I'm not saying you or I would roll out the ball and say, okay, hey, have fun. No, it's not what we're talking about. We're talking about we give them structure, and then within that structure, they have the freedom to break off that structure to make a decision that's advantageous. And then I can spend so much of my time on that advantage-disadvantage concept, which is ultimately, again, what all good basketball comes down to is, are you taking advantage of the advantage? Are you eliminating the disadvantage? You know, and those things that come with it. And we talked about it, and you pointed this out again when we talked a little bit about, was there value to that Marquette basketball offense blog that I posted with Coach Wojciechowski, talking a little bit about their secondary break concepts. And one of the things that came through to me was how he worded something, which I thought was brilliant, because we do it, but I didn't necessarily have the wording that I'm going to share and bring into my practice this year, is that, you know, missed shot offense. Well, yeah, we have a missed shot offense. But what he talked about more was taking it a step further. He said, okay, do you run your missed shot offense after a set doesn't work? Like, what do you run after a set doesn't work? And we have a system of reaction. You know, we have our second cut reaction. We have penetration reaction. We have offensive rebounding reaction. We have post reaction. But I thought the brilliance of kind of what he said and what he put into context was, like, do you have a missed shot offense? Yes. Okay, great. That makes sense. We all do. But do you have a offense after a set doesn't work? And that comes back to what we're talking about, is can your players play in those unstructured moments? So, you know, it's great that BDT, our conversation is connecting back to that concept of, you know, can they play? Can they play the game of basketball?
Right. And I think you've said it before too, when you talk about the three Fs of basketball.
Fun, freedom, and focus. It's certainly a method of branding the game for, I think, young people, and that's why I originally created it. But I created it for young people, but then, you know, as I'm coaching my players and I move fully into games approach and BDT and going all in on all this stuff, it's like that became our method of training, our method of practicing. And like, not all practice is fun. Like, there's always going to be parts of practice that are just going to be, you know, those kind of boring repetition. I mean, that's part of learning. So those focused repetitions are part of it. Well, fun doesn't mean frivolous fun either. It doesn't mean, like, you know, we're playing, as I say many times, duck, duck, goose in practice. We're playing, like, fun is competition. Fun is seeing yourself get better. Like, though, that's fun. Like, I think people...
Winning's fun.
Yeah. But I think people miss that point when they talk about players' enjoyment. You know what players really value? Getting better. Like, you as a coach noticing their progress and noticing them getting better, that's how you form a better relationship with a young player, is that you spend that time to notice their progress and really to point it out. And I don't mean point it out like false praise. I mean really notice something. And it could be something really simple. Like, your worst player was able to dribble it in a game 2 times without passing it to the other team. Like, it could be something completely simple like that, and just noticing that progress. Well, that player is going to enjoy the game more now, because they know that their practice effort has been translating into a better game performance. That's fun. And then the last part, freedom, is again, everything that we want, is that we want our players to play free. But I don't mean, again, free as in do whatever you want. It's free within the parameters that you define for your team. And shot selection is obviously something we could spend a whole talk on too. But, you know, shot selection for me is like, okay, well, Mark shoots the ball every time he touches it. Well, how are his teammates going to react to that? Is really the true judgment of a shot's value, I think. Like, coaches can define a shot as saying, okay, open in range, on in rhythm. Okay, that's all true. But at the end of the day, freedom for Mark is like, if he shoots a shot, do his teammates get angry at him? Do they get frustrated that he shoots
four other guys face palm? Then
it's right, exactly. Like that to me defines shot selection for a player. And it also defines whether it's true freedom or not. Like if you shoot a shot, Mark, and I'm on the sidelines and I go crazy because you shot a shot, then I definitely didn't give you freedom. Right? Now, right. At the end of the day, okay, if your teammates don't think you shot good shots, then they need to be the ones that work towards holding you accountable to that. And then I helped that process along. And, you know, I think that's one of those things that I think about when I think about freedom is freedom is ultimately defined by your teammates more than your coach in terms of that. Because if Mark's a really good player and all 20 shots he shot in a game were open, then really one of your teammates is going to criticize the fact that you shot an open shot. Well, no. But if you shot 10 of those shots were contested, taking a dribble, fading away, then yeah, your teammates have every right to take away some of your freedom, you know, in terms of holding you accountable. And I hope that makes sense to people because, you know, again, freedom is something certainly that's earned, but it's also something that's defined as much by, you know, your teammates and what is acceptable. Because I'm okay if Mark shoots 20 shots that are open, but I'm not okay if Mark shoots 20 shots that are contested. So there's a difference in terms of how you define freedom.
Right. And realistically, as a coach, there's a limit to what you can control on that. Obviously, you can sub somebody out. But, you know, if I'm getting in and I'm just throwing up shots, if I don't get the decision about what's a good shot, what's a, you know, what's an open shot for somebody else that might maybe a better shot, that's the whole what Greg Popovich is, right? The San Antonio good to great.
Right.
Shoot a good shot, but give it up for a great shot for somebody else.
I've stolen that, and you talk about that all the time, and that's advantage disadvantage, right? Even if you're open, sometimes someone's going to have a better shot than you, and that's teaching and understanding advantage disadvantage. But what I worry about at the youth level with that is that obviously then they become passers, right? Because there's always going to be someone better than them. Whereas freedom for me is giving the permission is probably the wrong word, but giving someone the permission to shoot when they're open. And even if they miss it, being supportive of the process of them making the decision to shoot it. Because that ultimately will lead to them enjoying the game more, practicing more to improve their ability to shoot it. And hopefully, again, getting your team to buy into this concept of everyone being a basketball player and not just, as we said, a number. We want everyone to be a basketball player, not a position. We want them to be a basketball player.
Yeah. And I think that we talked a little bit about this also, too, about I don't know whether it's a generational thing, but it seems like there's a lot more, I want to say, negativity, whether it's every mistake you make gets posted on YouTube or Snapchat or something like that. It's hard enough. I mean, I've got guys that take shots, and if they miss a shot, they're beating themselves up way more than anybody else would. And there's a struggle from that side to just say, listen, part of it is just kind of the positive self-talk. I mean, you don't really gain anything by, you know, I shoot, I miss a shot. Oh, you know, Jesus, I suck and I'm never going to make another shot. And I'm talking to myself three possessions later about the shot I missed.
Yeah, that play present mentality for sure.
Yeah, and it seems like that's, I don't know, for some reason that seems, I want to say more prevalent.
But that's a question. Who defines that? Like, is that the player truly feeling that way,
or is that a player acting a way that their coaches and their parents and society deems that they should act? That they should act that way to a certain extent. Because if you miss a shot, it's the worst thing that's happened in the world. Coach reacts negatively. Parents react negatively. So you react negatively. And I'm saying, like, does the mentality of the coach and the mentality, like, if I'm coaching young people, like in a team situation, I'm spending as much time in short meetings with my parents as possible to explain to them what we're doing and why we're doing it so that they react a certain way. And that's it. I mean, we've talked about this. That shot is like, we don't want the parents going, oh, why did you shoot that? Well, no, they're open. Look, I get it. Mark's not as good a shooter as Joey. But look, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about winning or are we talking about player development? Because there's a huge difference in that shot selection based on those two things. Because if we're just talking about winning, then yeah, I want Joey to shoot the shot. You know, even if it's contested, probably he's a better shooter than Mark wide open. But if we're talking about true development, then it's the decision that is going to spark the development. The decision to shoot the ball, the decision to play offense, the decision to be free is going to spark their desire to get better. Because if they're just a passer and they're never allowed to shoot or they're never allowed real freedom, then yeah, it's going to limit their desire to work on their game.
Yeah, and that's also like kind of like that short-term, long-term focus. If you're focused on the short-term of him missing that shot, at the end of the season when you play the same team, you haven't gotten any better.
Right.
Because
no, it's so true.
He hasn't improved.
Like, it's too bad we can't evaluate a coach
on that. Because really, a true evaluation of a youth coach, and to be honest, I mean, a lot of levels of coaching, I even feel like somewhat my goal is to develop my players to their next level if possible. So there's a certain amount of that too, is did they shoot that shot that they didn't shoot at the beginning of the year? Yeah, absolutely. That's development. Like, that is the ultimate development, because that player, one, feels confident to shoot that shot, or they feel free to shoot that shot. And both of those are valuable for their development moving forward. And that's a coach-controlled expectation, or to a certain extent, a teammate-controlled expectation that I think, again, like, it's decisions are individual player development concepts. Like, they're not just team concepts. And I think that's, again, where BDT comes back to, and that word that we use, which is you're an active participant in your learning. Well, that's the other thing. I've had a coach, actually a number of coaches, if I was to be truly honest, ask me, why do you call them learners? Like, I'm like, why do you call them learners? Like, I've never heard that before, a coach said to me. I'm like, wait a minute, aren't they learners? Like, it was just such an interesting frame of reference, probably where they were coming from, that I couldn't even comprehend. And I get that. Like, they're, okay, it's a player. It's a player. But I often call them learners, because that's how I want them to frame themselves. So, you know, they're an active participant. Well, they're a learner. You know, and we'll talk to our players in that, and we'll address them as learners, you know, because ultimately that's the goal.
Yeah, and I think it reinforces too your role as a coach, right? As coach, as a teacher. So the teaching skill is also just almost as important as the X's and O's.
No, it's, and again, I mean, for all this,
I mean, it seems simple when we talk about it, the application of all these things within a diverse learning group, it's certainly more difficult. And, you know, there's accountability to sometimes your administration, to your fans, to your parents, you know, to all these different pressures. And it makes it a little bit harder sometimes to not structure things so it looks like people are being successful. And that's a challenge for you as a coach, especially when you talk about individual player development. Because individual player development to me is very selfish. Like, it's focused on that individual getting better. Whereas if I'm talking about a team focus, then I'm focused on our team being able to execute and play the game in a way that's going to help our team be successful. And that doesn't always coincide with player development. Those two things definitely sometimes don't work together. But as we circle back to this, it's like, okay, if my individual players get better, then I basically have a new roster by the time I get to the, you know, to the point that maybe winning matters. And that's why we'll always focus on that. And that's why, again, the way that we practice, I feel every minute is individual player development, because we're focused on the decisions as much as the skills.
And that's one of the great things I think about too, about being involved in a team sport, is it just, you know, you get to share those moments and having players support each other and help each other along as they say, okay, yeah, here's why you want to go here. And then they become, so now there's your increase in your coaching staff, when all of a sudden you've got five players helping you coach. And I just had a reunion of my college team a little while back, and it was amazing how many of us had the same specific identification of things that were involved with the team, whether it was a particular play or even something like just being after, hey, remember when we were all hanging out, what album were we listening to?
How cool is that?
75 years ago. I already gave it away because I used the album instead of CD, right? But yeah.
How cool is that?
That team dynamic and the fact that as the team gets better, sharing that and being a part of a team is really something really awesome.
Well, and that leads into
maybe the last point I'll make, but I've never had a team where the best player hasn't shot it the most over the course of a season. Like, even with an open kind of free philosophy, players know, right? Like yeah. You're saying, like, players know. Like, players, the things that players remember and the things that players know, like, if the goal truly is for everyone to be successful, then you know who the best players are, and you know who should be shooting the ball the most. And that doesn't have to be defined by a coach. Like, I generally would say at the youth level, why even bother? I mean, most players know. And I bet you that best player is always going to get the most shots or close to the most shots within a team. And I've had that conversation many times with some of my best players, is just say, hey, like, you don't need to force a shot early. Like, you know that, number one, the defense is really focused on you. Number two, over the course of a game, it always works out. It always works out because your teammates know. I mean, your teammates really do know. And that good to great philosophy applies to you. Like, that's what good to great is. And that's part of it. So, you know, BDT, freedom, this concept of players' enjoyment of the game, all these things mixed together in terms of, you know, that overall player development and individual player development philosophy. But, you know, I guess to sum up, it applies to all levels. Like, it really does, because we're talking about a general system of understanding the game and a general system of training that, from my college level onto some of my pro players that have gone on to play professionally to the youth players I work with. I mean, I train them essentially the same after initial learning. And that's because we focus so much on that decision and the skill being combined. So anything, last thoughts to add there, Mark?
No, I think that's awesome. I just really enjoyed going over some of this stuff here, and good start to this summer season, summer camp season.
Well, it's a great start to the conversations, and I hope people enjoy it, and please comment on Twitter at B-Ball Immersion or on our Facebook at Basketball Immersion. And just let us know, because Mark and I certainly have many conversations in us to be able to continue many of these conversations. And we look forward to answering not just some of the questions that Mark or I may have for each other, but also questions that you may have for us as well as we move forward with this podcast over the next, hopefully, long time. Thanks for joining me, Mark.
Excellent. Thanks, Coach. See you soon.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.